You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
All right, I see our first speaker rejoining us here. So we'll go ahead and get started. We have a busy next session, three papers to get through, so I'll remind everybody of the rules. First, I'm Rich Reifel. I'm a professor of finance practice at WashU's Olin School of Business. So we'll have same rules as David outlined, 15 minutes for the research presentation, 10 minutes for the discussion, and then 15 minutes for civil Q&A. Generally, a question ends with a question mark. So if we could make sure that when you get the microphone, you give us your affiliation, and this isn't Jeopardy, so state your question like a question. So let's all try to do our best to keep on schedule. So our first topic of three really cool topics, I think, which will generate some cordial and heated discussion, is investor attention and municipal bond returns. And presenting the research is John Hun from the University of Georgia, after which Brad Wendt from the Department of Treasury will come up to discuss the work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Awesome. Thanks. I'll see whether I have a laser or not. My parole officer's a little more forgiving, I think. But thank you all for the opportunity to present this. It's a paper on attention and bond returns. The big picture here really is stated in very academic terms, and it's sort of how informationally efficient, which means one thing in sort of academic ease and another thing to lots of other people. So I kind of revised our question a little bit to put it into better context, which is how do investors in municipal bond markets use readily available information from other markets? And in other words, you know, another sort of, I used to have a practitioner type job as well. And so one thing that we always talked about was silos, information silos. This is sort of how informationally siloed the municipal bond market was, at least during the financial crisis. Our answer, just to, in case you want to leave early, you want to do anything, our answer is no. It is our sort of papers, you know, hopefully civil finding that at least through the crisis, the municipal market remained very, very segmented from other markets that provided information that should have been probably, you know, could have been easily transacted upon. And in particular, what we're going to do is we're going to use something that was talked about in the last discussion, which was the implosion of the monoline bond insurance market. And we're basically going to do one thing and one thing only, a simple thing. We're going to compare the returns of insured bonds with the returns of uninsured bonds and see what happens when the market sort of market has different information about the health of those insurers. So what do you think our contributions are? We hope, again, we should have put I hope up here. We hope this is a clean and rigorous analysis of what type of shocks muni investors respond to, whether they look at sort of stock and CDS and other types of markets to bring them information for trading, or do they sort of rely much more on ratings? Again, a topic that we sort of just left, and I'm going to pick up on it again. It turns out that equity and CDS markets seem to give information that should have been acted on and in some ways did not seem to be acted upon, both by retail and institutional investors. Changes in ratings do tend to prompt some selling. That's primarily by institutions. Retail investors tend to sort of not change their perspective as these bond insurers are imploding. And like I said, the market remains segmented. We have a little backdoor contributions that we won't talk a little bit too much about. It turns out if you're a AAA insurer, Insurance is actually kind of valuable, and we'll show evidence that underlying rated bonds have very similar returns when they're wrapped by AAA insurance, and then only when that AAA value of insurance disappears do the returns begin to split apart. And then we also do some backdoor type stuff, which I'm not going to touch on a ton here, which is dealing with a lot of the complications and heterogeneity and illiquidity in the market. So we need some sort of events, right? I told you this is going to be an event study. We're going to see what happens. And what's lucky for us, I guess in some ways, unlucky for others, is that the rating agencies are somewhat slow to the switch here. And effectively, we have a downgrade date. Use my laser, I guess. Somewhere here. Anyway, my parole is a little more restrictive than I thought. Here's where we call the distress date, right? Here is where the insurers are downgraded. This is a plot of the stock prices of MBIA and AMBAC, and what you can see is that they begin losing significant market value through here. And what's nice about this for us is that we're going to call one of those things the distress date when CDS and stock market investors seem to be saying these insurers are not only not AAA, they're functionally bankrupt. And the rating agencies downgrade about 7 to 8 months later. And so we're going to use the sort of differential behavior within there to check and see how the returns on an insured portfolio and an uninsured portfolio differ. Did people know that the insurers were kind of circling the drain in 2007? Well, people were certainly telling them, right? So Pershing Square Capital put together a 145-page PowerPoint presentation that was widely circulated in Reuters and the FT, saying that MBIA is going to be bankrupt by second quarter 2018. Of course, people are going to take that a little with a grain of salt because Bill Ackman was short billions and billions of dollars of MBIA. But there's a lot of analysis in this thing. More importantly, what you can see, we pulled from MBIA's 10Ks and things like that. You can see that they are loading up on structured products, the top line CDOs, right? And keeping their sort of bond market business very, very similar. You can see the drop in the market value of their equity from almost $10 billion to $2 billion using some sort of a structural model of distance default, sort of like KMV would use, to imply a probability of default. This leads to a 17% probability of default, which is somewhat associated with a CAA rating at the end of 2007 rather than the AAA rating they were carrying. We steal a little bit from a paper by Creel, Gramsci, and Tse, who use a super complicated, best way I can describe it, way of implying ratings from CDS spreads. And one of their examples is AMBAC, where they show that AMBAC is effectively defaulted by the end of 2007 based on their sort of CDS clustering of stuff. So we feel like there's a lot of distress in 2007 people should have picked up on. Here's a quick glance at our data. We use Mergent like lots of other people. One of the things that's very, very careful to note about Mergent is that it does a very bad job of telling you who's insuring what, because it overwrites the insurer field. So we go back and resupply it with the novated portfolios of all the bankrupt insurers, FSA and FGIC and CFFG and Radian and all the other ones. So we get a better picture of who's actually being insured by whom. Right, so just a caveat, if you want to go back to the Mergent and use the insurer stuff, it's kind of a mess. The ratings are not, there's no ratings history there, so you need to come up with your own ratings history. Kim's co-author Ryan has a very, very large and sort of comprehensive ratings history pulled directly from the websites using lots of, I don't know, high-tech stuff too, that has Moody's and S&P ratings for everything. So we add those in. We then add those to every trade of every municipal bond security tracked by MSRB and piece these things together with some CRISP and some Bloomberg and mutual fund holding data. So it's a pretty comprehensive of data set. So we can say every bond, almost every bond that was issued and almost every trade of every bond. And the reason that we need all this is because we have to do something that most people who do these things don't have to confront, which is that this market is highly illiquid. So one of the issues is that we have to create our own bond indices. and creating indices out of very illiquid securities with stable portfolios is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, especially when you want to begin to stratify them on insured and uninsured and AAA by AA underlying and by MBA and so on and so forth. So what we do in the paper, well, one thing we'll point out is that you can't just use average yields. So one thing that you might think is, oh, let's just look at the yields before and after. But the problem is when there's news, the affected bonds trade more, so you get yield information on those, whereas the unaffected bonds don't trade anywhere near as much. So you basically are selecting on which yield is being traded, and so it contaminates lots of your results. So we go sort of deep into this literature, which we're not going to spend. You should read the paper because this part's pretty cool, but we're not going to spend any time on it. And what we do is we basically use a lot of the information, sort of the techniques from real estate, to create municipal bond indices, because housing sales are also characteristic dependent and sort of very illiquid. So we sort of modify, we take the starting point of a paper by Spiegel and Starks, which do this for corporate bonds. We have sort of even more illiquidity, so we do some modifications to come up with basically return indices for MBIA insured, AMBAC insured, and also sub-ratings within each one of those, as well as, of course, a benchmark AAA uninsured return index. Here's kind of the big picture of the paper. So right about right here is our distress date, and right about here is where the downgrades happen. And what you can see is that as the downgrades begin to happen, what happens is the yields on the insured bonds begin to diverge really heavily from the sort of uninsured benchmark. Right? And that's the key thing. The interesting thing is that regardless of underlying rating, the portfolio by AMBAC and MBIA, all the way up until middle of 2008, lays directly on top of the AAA uninsured bond index, as it were. And that in some ways tells you that people are valuing the return. These returns are the same. I don't care whether the insurance wrap has some value. You know, I'm basically trading this bond as if it's a AAA bond. But as soon as, you know, the market is blowing up, you know, MBIA is in the papers for having its equity go to $5 a share. I still don't update about whether my insurance is valuable. It's only after the insurance drops to, you know, the ratings go from AAA to AA that we begin to see these things break apart. And we have a sort of a formal mathy test of the divergence of these. You know, before the distress date, no statistical significance. Between the distress and downgrade date, no statistical significance. As soon as after the downgrade hits, there's a big piece of they're obviously, you look at the picture, right? So this is the fancy number that quantifies what this picture says. We can plot the difference essentially day by day with sort of standard errors. Again, we generate these standard errors by essentially not just computing the indices once, right? The sort of super complicated, you know, repeat sales regression indices. We don't do that just once. We do that 500 times, and we bootstrap out of that and create these standard errors. And so the methodology for that is kind of cool, and it's very helpful if you want to do this type of work. And it's all detailed, you know, in the paper. So I'll leave it at that. The big point here is nothing happens before the dotted line, and essentially nothing really, really happens, you know, until the other line is actually conveniently right where the screen breaks. So thank you, Brookings, right? Like that line is exactly where the downgrade is, and so you can begin to see essentially that line is where they statistically begin to diverge. We look at net order flow to see whether big trades, which we define as above $100,000, are causing small trades or small traders are leading big traders. And we find a little bit of evidence that the institutions are the ones who do the selling in the post-downgrade period, but not at no point in the pre-downgrade period. More fanciness. So we set up a causality test to see whether returns in the bond market cause returns in the stock market, which also might cause returns in the CDS market. We put all three of those things together for each one of these insurers and see whether, hey, do MBIA stock returns lead the information in the underlying portfolio of bonds that they insure? Does AMBAC CDS lead the changes in AMBAC CDS lead the returns in the AMBAC portfolio? And what you can kind of see, the big point here is that the bond, nothing influences them except the other bonds, right? So the stocks and CDS of the underlying insurer don't influence at all over this period the returns on the portfolios in which they insure. There's a little bit of interesting thing, side note that MBIA CDS is kind of the thing that's driving things, partly because we believe that Pershing Square Capital is pushing things around at some point here. There's a lot of number of ways. I mean, that's just the raw numbers. What we're going to say is that we can say fairly confidently, I'm not sure I want to give up a kidney, but I mean fairly confidently that returns on uninsured and insured bonds sort of don't change until the downgrade. And there's a number of explanations. One of the explanations is that insurance never had any value. It didn't have any value at all. There, you know, investors were right to ignore it, and you know, they should have. And if that's the case, we went back though to see how much MBIA and AMBAC were paid over the period from 1995 to 2008, and that number is very big. We have direct evidence they picked up almost $10 billion in insurance in gross premiums over that entire period. That's a lot of money, and based on their sort of coverage of the market from also their annual reports, that implies that the entire total market is $17 billion in money that was paid into the insurance industry over this period, right? For effectively something that disappeared. There are other explanations, right? It could be that there's no default risk in the muni market. I should be more clear that there's very little default risk in the state general obligation bonds, which are underlying our indices, right? And that's certainly very, very possible. We went back and redid all of the indices and drew a picture with using revenue bonds, right? Because we figured that they have a substantially higher risk of default, and we can kind of. This is the revenue bond picture, which you can see looks almost identical. Again, thank you, Brookings. The line lines up right there. That's the downgrade line, and it lines up exactly like you'd expect. So we feel like it's not the fact that there isn't a default risk. It's a financial crisis. So there's a lot of moving parts. Lehman Brothers is going on here, things like that. We study order flow to see who is selling around the Lehman Brothers crisis, and show that there's very little change in order activity around the Lehman. This is a pre-Lehman event, and the downgrade leads Lehman by about 2 to 3 months. So the effects we're picking up are kind of pre-Lehman. It's certainly possible that people knew this and found it very difficult to short the muni market and express their things. It doesn't sort of explain why you would sell immediately after the downgrade. And if you knew that this was going to happen, it might have been a better idea to sell a little bit earlier, right? So the lack of shorting could have caused something here, but it's not necessarily maybe driving the entire thing. So I'm trying to stay on target. Are we doing good? Yeah. Oh, I'm over. Oh, then I'm done. Then I'm done because I'd really like to hear what Brad has to say. So,
just slide 9. Can we go to slide 9, please? Great.
Hi, my name is Brad Wendt, and one quick disclaimer. I'm talking about these slides in this excellent paper as a capital markets professional of 25 years, not as someone who's been at the U.S. Treasury for 5 weeks. So please take it as Brad Wendt, the capital markets practitioner, And when Rich and I had the opportunity to talk to John about the paper, we actually had a lot of fun with John, just because I think there's so many elements to it, and he has such enthusiasm for something that I think you almost have to be a Muni geek to have this type of enthusiasm. But I have to hand it to John. His enthusiasm was jumping through the speakerphone. But one thing which Rich and I kind of uncovered, and I think in a way it supports and also kind of contradicts the hypothesis that John has, is the simple fact that he uncovered during a four-year period what we call a true AAA, in the Muni world, either a true AAA, a real AAA, whatever you want to call it, something as, a GO AAA versus insured. For that period, they traded right on top of each other, which having sat on my share of municipal desk, Rich had the same experience. We just said, how could that possibly be? So what that tells you is there's a point in time in the municipal market where it wasn't that bond insurance had no value, but you could actually argue from your own analysis that it had a tremendous amount of value. And due to the fact that, I think of it as belt and suspenders, where you had the AAA wrap and you had a very solid underlying rating that maybe they actually thought 1 + 1 = 3 in a true AAA. So I thought that was just fascinating research he did. And the next thing, what I want to do is he used a little of my time, but I think it's more interesting to... No, I'm happy to have him use my time with his enthusiasm. I like his paper, but not as much as he does. But but the point being that I almost like to hear from the audience. I have a couple hypotheses why this occurred. And one hypothesis is we all know about liquidity. Actually, in John's paper, he uses the term QSIP to explain the number of bonds out there. And once again, we tend to think of bond issues at about a million, as we know. But in terms of QSIPs that he actually looked at, which is just a subset of all the QSIPs out there, he looked at 3 million QSIPs. So what does that tell you? We're a lot of smart people here, but no one can trade 3 million names. So I think it goes back to one of the hypotheses that the bond insurers have always presented was liquidity. So if you have this water and sewer district in some small town in Iowa, it's a great name. The locals love that credit, but, is a New Yorker going to buy it? Probably not because of the tax exemption. So you're back to Iowa, and they're going to buy their homegrown product. So I think the point being that the liquidity that bond insurance provided has to, I'm coming up with reasons why this phenomenon occurred. Cannot be discounted is all I'm saying there. I think it's very interesting that there was a break in the trading value, but the break in the trading value was after the AAAs got downgraded. Obviously, the power of the ratings is very, very important when you're dealing with a retail marketplace, and no one at the retail level, with rare exceptions, has the ability to do their own credit analysis. So you really can't fault someone who knows that he or she has a wrap on top. And the one thing, another great paper for you to do retrospectively is, I think it's a good idea, but the underwriting of the MBA, FSA, AMBAC, FIDIC, it was great. And we all know the reason they went down wasn't because of muni defaults. There's a couple toe stubs out there, and we all know which toe stubs are out there. But the point being, you could almost use bond insurance as a housekeeping seal of approval. So I went out, bought this paper in a water and sewer district in Iowa that no one ever heard of, but I know someone else did a nice job of underwriting. So hence, the fact that it might be upward sticky is another reason. The final thing, and I don't know if we got any hardcore credit experts in here, but I can't remember Moody's or S&P, in terms of what I would call joint ratings, where the famous 1 + 1 = 3. So there, you could actually rationalize that there is, I understand, in the rating world, if you have a single A here and you have a single A wrap, the combination of those two don't necessarily equal A. It could equal double A. So I just want to throw that out also as a reason for it being upward sticky is the fact that these things, unlike when the other graph was the one with the credit default swaps, where they're kind of dropping off a cliff. You know, the dollar price of CDS is pretty high, so it was actually very violent. But remember when the munis were bond insurers were downgraded, they didn't go down triple C overnight. They obviously went down to double A. So if you think of joint ratings, a double A and a single A, maybe that's pretty good. So I'm just throwing out alternatives. I think it's outstanding research. I certainly don't have the answer, but I'd certainly like to defer to Rich and the audience in terms of their theories. There definitely is a phenomenon right there during that period of time that the news was out there, the bond market didn't react. And it did react once the rating services formally downgraded the bond insurers. So come up.
Start our Q&A session here. First question, John Chalmers.
I was curious if you have any of your sample that actually got upgraded from like a single A with insurance that then had a double A underlying with insurance, and you could see if actually the 1+1 equaled -1, or I thought that might be an interesting thing to look at in terms of the information.
That's actually really, really pretty interesting. The way that we have it set up now, we sort of have the portfolios are constant credit quality. So when you get upgraded, you transition from one index to another, right? So there's a little bit of that going on, but we could look really explicitly at the just the changes in the and see whether that changes the return. So that's a really good suggestion, actually.
Do you understand?
Yes. Just a couple of observations. First, I think it was October 29th, 2007, when Moody's announced that they were going to look at the capital requirements of the bond insurers and the capital construct. And then I think it was a couple days later that S&P and then Fitch followed shortly thereafter. So the market, I think, was keenly aware, the institutional market was keenly and acutely aware that there was something going on with the monolines. And we all traced it back to 2004 when GE spun off FGIC to Blackstone. If you can't make a 7% return on capital, then when can you? But I think also there were a confluence of other things that were going on at the same time that I'd be interested in knowing if you've considered these things or maybe you want to account for them. One was, As the ratings on the insurers got downgraded, it collapsed. It forced collapsed tender option bond programs, which fed illiquidity in the market. Number two, because of the auction rate problems, dealer firms were not committing the firm's capital. They weren't committing their balance sheet, so they were no longer a bid. So I guess the question, I'll wrap it up by saying, I'm not so sure you can isolate ratings. And we did see things like Mass State Geo's unenhanced trading cheaper than through Mass Geo enhanced. In other words, you were being penalized for the same credit, that was wrapped. But there were a confluence of a bunch of things that were going on there. And to isolate them into the value of insurance or not, I think maybe simplifying the problem.
Yeah. There's a lot of activity both by the rating agencies and by the insurers themselves raising capital. There's a number of sort of novation periods. There's a lot of stuff that's going on in exactly this time. We tried to pick. We have to pick. A downgrade in some ways. We picked the kind of big one, but there was certainly a period. Certainly a negative outlook for MBIA. And what's interesting is if you look at one of the slides, there's a downtick of the MBI in between the distress and the downgrade date. There's a downtick in MBIA, but not AMBAC, which corresponds very closely to the sort of negative outlook announcement. So we're very sensitive to the fact that there's a lot of other stuff going on here. And it's one of the reasons in a very early draft we had FSA and FGIC and a number of other sort of the other insurers floating around. But because they're not public, it was very difficult to figure out
who was doing what and who was taking over pieces of people's portfolios. So we felt like this was the cleanest thing we could. But we're going to agree it's not perfectly clean, for sure.
Dan,
first
question. Dan's got a question.
Yeah, so Dan Bergstresser from Brandeis. I love this paper. I'm fascinated by it. I would have looked in a while ago to some of the divergence between the insured and uninsured, and in what I've seen, and this matched the history of the liquidation of the tender option bond programs and the liquidation of a couple of sort of highly levered muni hedge funds like the Duration Capital getting liquidated in February. So I'm really surprised because this actually doesn't match my priors about where you would have seen the breakpoint, which I would have put at maybe February 12th, 13th, rather than August. And so I'm curious about digging in on exactly where you're finding the breakpoint, which was more in the August.
The breakpoint, I mean, if we were just going to let the data sort of tell us where things break apart, it would probably be sometime in, I would say,
I talk loud anyway, so it would probably be sometime in July to early August of the, I would say late July of the of things, sort of right. But there's movement right after the downgrade. It's, you know, there's a, like I said, there's a tick in MBIA sometime in February, March, and the tender auction bond thing could be doing that, but it could also be the negative outlook thing. There's like a number of things that all stack up in late February thing. And so we picked two dates and like I said, there, we tried to keep as much of a gap between them so we could see what we could see.
So reminiscent of Dan's skin in the game.
And we cite your paper too.
Kim, did you want to add something to that, Kim?
Okay.
Other questions? So I did have a question. I'm wondering if we would see the same phenomenon in the other insured markets,
such as the
ABS market.
ABS market. I honestly don't know. I don't have.
My sense is that's a more sophisticated market, if you will.
We do know that the financial guarantors did a very. I mean, I agree with Brad that the financial insurers did a really good job of underwriting municipal business. It's fairly clear in retrospect that they did an exceptionally poor job of underwriting insurance on structured products. They were very late to the game. They jump in, and as I was talking to someone earlier today, you can see they're in their annual reports. There's a line in Ambac's annual report where they report the value of their CDS, and it's $10 million market value, and then 1 year it's -$6 billion, and so it jumps from $10 million to -$6 billion. In 1 year, and it seems to me that's a revaluation of an entire methodology, not just market values. So
there are some that argue, though, that the ratings agencies actually forced them to diversify their revenue stream. I'm sorry.
Kim will know. We've long had sort of less confidence in rating agencies than many people have. So there is sort of, I think, room to say who's doing a good job. But back to the original, I'm not convinced. It would be interesting. I don't know. Getting insurance data on structured products would be very, very difficult, I think.
I mean, those migrations seem to be extremely rapid, like in a day, So,
I mean, we can find their CDO portfolio, but not the RMBS portfolio.
Right. On the ABS, I think it's a neat idea, Rich. Then you're away from a retail marketplace.
Right.
So I would think it'd be fascinating to see if it just dropped off the cliff. But once again, getting back to the retail investor, and I love your paper, but, almost sounds like since they didn't sell that they were not observing events out there. When you look at that, when you look at that slide, which is my favorite slide, slide 9, if you're a retail investor, you're preservation of capital. And according to that slide 9, with those returns, there's a little gap, but everyone's still paying their grocery bills off of that interest income. So it's I think one thing I would point to is more emphasis on the fact who was the end holder of munis, which are obviously vastly individuals.
I think we're going to have time for one more question.
Yeah, I guess related, and I apologize, I haven't read the paper. I'm sorry.
Tell us your affiliation.
Oh, Carolyn Walsh, I'm with Steptoe & Johnson. I guess I'm wondering also that you focus on MBIA and AMBAC, and would your results have been any different, or if you look, why did you exclude Assured Guaranty? Who performed differently during the crisis?
Yes, so we had some in an earlier draft. We can with Assured in it. Part of the problem is Assured the bonds that Assured trade pre-crisis are very, very, very sparse. So the bonds that were insured by Assured are very, very, very sparse. So it's very difficult to create the sort of portfolio index for Assured in the pre-crisis period. It, you know, once they get almost the entire market, it's very, very, we can do that, but we need to have the whole period. So in a lot of ways, it's a data sparseness thing. It's nothing we wanted to do. In fact, our original sort of picture was, if you look at Assured stock price, it stays almost constant. So we wanted to show the picture where MBIA and AMBAC drop off and Assured stays very solvent through things. And we wanted to show the portfolio of Assured, but it was very, very hard to construct the Assured bond return portfolios.
Brad, do you have any last comments?
Right.
All right, I'm gonna leave it at that to give us time to transition.
I do want to say one thing that I want to thank Brad. He points out, I think, one of the biggest pieces that we don't address here, which is liquidity. We don't talk very much about it. I kind of want to put it. We're going to put a quick commercial. We're also trying to write a liquidity paper that I sent to Brad. And so I was just going to say, if you have any thoughts about that, we'd be really happy to get them.
Well, we're certainly trying to match practitioners with academics. So if anybody wants to throw in with John and Kim, please do.
Thank you,
gentlemen. And apropos liquidity, organizational form and liquidity evidence from closed-end and open-end municipal bond funds with John Chalmers from University of Oregon, and then our discussant will be Steve Winterstein following him. So thank you.
So I couldn't have asked for a better introduction, John. Thank you very much for the liquidity introduction and its importance. I even have a few liquidity jokes in here, so I hope you hope you'll get those too. But before I start, I guess one thing I wanted to just say is to thank the organizers for putting this conference together. From an academics perspective, this is a great opportunity for us to learn an awful lot about things we don't know because we don't experience them every day. And I'm going to go on a little aside here, back to my graduate student days. One of the sages in our department, who's the editor of one of the academic journals, often said to the new PhD students, he said, "The most important journal to read is not the Journal of Financial Economics," which, if I ask for a show of hands, I bet none of you have ever read other than the academics, "the Journal of Finance or the Review of Financial Studies. It's the Wall Street Journal." You're welcome, David. But he did say that, and the best topics come from that. And so this is an opportunity for us to hear from you. You know, are we doing something that makes any sense, that's helpful, that has policy implications that we should take seriously? And so I welcome those comments and that inspiration for new ideas. So this paper is a brand new paper. It's a mess. I apologize, but we got it done in time. It was not done at 10:30 last night. We were in a week ago, on time, on schedule, just not well done. Okay, but it has the ideas in it.
Don't oversell it.
The ideas are in it. So this is written with Jay Wong, who's an associate professor at Oregon also, and Jingyun Yang, who's now, she's a recently graduated PhD student. And so let me start out with some very 1990s graphics here. So if we start, our basic idea, let me just go back to the title, Organizational Form and Liquidity, Evidence from Closed-End, Open-End Municipal Bond Funds. So let me first talk a little bit about open-end and closed-end municipal bond funds. So there's a huge difference in the way you manage one of these funds, and you all know much more about this than I do probably, but just to make sure we're on the same page. On an open-end fund, when somebody redeems their shares, the fund manager has to sell something, often holds some cash, but has to sell some of their assets. And so on that left diagram, the left circle, on Monday, our assets are big. On Tuesday, somebody leaves the fund. Our assets are smaller. We have to get rid of something. Closed-end funds aren't like that. So on Monday and Tuesday, they have the same number of assets because when somebody leaves that fund, they have to find somebody else to take their place. So we have this woman walking in with a bag of money. She gives it to the person that's leaving, but the money stays in the fund. So there isn't a need to liquidate. Okay, and that's a big difference when you think about what the fund manager has to do on a daily basis. So Finance for 1000, Alex, I just spent 2 weeks with my mother-in-law, and one of our bonding opportunities is watching Jeopardy. So that's the inspiration here. Finance for 1000, Alex, an explanation for virtually any asset pricing anomaly. What is liquidity, Alex? Okay, so this is the answer when finance people don't know the answer. Okay, just to kind of put it out there. So the municipal bond market, and we've talked about this in the earlier sessions, is a market that's commonly held up as an example of an illiquid market that is a big market. There are few trades in any particular asset, and we know that from lots of work, but especially Harrison POR was one of the first to really show that in very extensive data analysis. And then trades are relatively expensive, especially those retail trades. So a theory for why we see closed-end funds is out there among the academics, and I'm going to just cite one of them, but the idea is that it allows investors to more efficiently own less liquid assets. So if you want to buy an illiquid asset, you do it as John Chalmers. I want to go out and buy $25,000 worth of City of Eugene bonds. Or do I want to go buy a closed-end fund that specializes in Oregon bonds? So Cherkis, Seiji, and Stanton have this paper where they say the value of a closed-end fund really comes from three parts. First of all, the NAV. So the value of the actual assets. Second of all, a set of capitalized liquidity benefits, and it contributes to the value, less the manager's fees. And so there are some factors in the municipal bond market that suggest that these capitalized liquidity benefits might be quite large. So first of all, in contrast to equity markets, a big trade of municipal bonds is cheaper than a small trade of municipal bonds. So on a percentage basis, you lose more value by trading big lots rather than small lots. If a fund knows it can hold a bond to maturity, the fund doesn't have to trade absent leverage, so it will never have to incur some costs if it's a closed-end fund without leverage. Closed-end funds are exchange-traded, while municipals are traded OTC, so there might be some benefits there. I don't actually know the answer to that, but my guess is it's a little bit cheaper to trade the closed-end fund than it is to trade the underlying assets. Okay, so what do we do in this paper? So do closed-end funds hold less liquid assets? We asked that question. Does closed-end fund leverage interact with the liquidity choices? And then do closed-end funds earn a liquidity premium? So this would be the idea that these funds are doing this for small investors so that you can earn a little bit extra return for taking on less liquid assets. So again, the results in here are preliminary, but we're pretty confident about some of them, and I'll point out the ones we're less confident about. So we have data in the paper about pre-crisis and post or during crisis data. I'm going to focus on the pre-crisis data, and then I'll make a few comments about what we find during the crisis. But we would expect that returns during the crisis for less liquid assets should be relatively poor compared to more liquid assets, and that's largely what we find. So before we start, I'm gonna also simplify my discussion and focus on just one of our measures of liquidity. We have four. The one I'm going to focus on is basically a bid-ask spread or a realized bid-ask spread or a dealer markup. So we basically just take the price of a sell minus the price of the buy divided by the price of the buy. So it's a percentage of the assets that were expended to make that trade. And what I'm showing you here is a chart from a different paper. And this paper is with Jay Wong also and another one of our PhD students. And what this just shows, and this is right around, I don't have the laser either, Dan. I didn't think I had a parole officer. But just around the period from 2003 through 2006, the levels of those bid-ask spreads or those markups. And this top, the top blue represents the smallest trades. So on the order of trades that are 25,000 and below, the bottom, the purple, represents trades that are $1 million and above in par value. And what you see here, and the left-hand scale is in basis points, so you can see that these markups for the biggest trades are on the order of 30 to somewhere between 30 and 60 basis points, where for the retail, the super retail, if you will, those blue trades are on the order of 240 basis points, certainly at the beginning of this period. So again, that's just to give you a sense that these markups vary dramatically by trade size. And at least in the muni market, these look large compared to what you would see in stock markets. Okay, so in terms of the data we're using in this paper, and there's a lot of it, so we have 712 open-end funds, and we have 296 closed-end funds. The average size of those open-end funds is $660 million. They have, on average, zero leverage, on average, 200 different names. On average, a maturity of 13.7 years, annualized quarterly returns of 5.32%, and 3-month markup is an average of 0.39, so 39 basis points. The closed-end funds, on the other hand, are a little bit smaller. They have leverage on average, although there are several of these closed-end funds that don't have leverage. They have fewer holdings, 135 versus 200. They have longer maturities, 19 versus 13, and they have higher returns, and they also have higher markups. So this is 0.75. Unlike John's presentation, this one isn't helped. The cut is cutting my 7.5s in half. But so at least at first glance, these are just summary statistics, averages of these data. We do see things that are consistent. We see higher returns. We see more risk taking. We see fewer holdings. And we also see higher markups. Okay, so apologies for the small font here, but so this is the answer to the question: do closed-end funds hold less liquid assets, and does leverage matter? So these are the first two questions that I asked, and the answer to both is I think yes. So if we look at the difference between these two sets, these are 12-month round trip transaction costs. These are just measured over a 3-month interval. I'll just focus on this right side. And that top green circle up at the top, you can see is a dummy variable. For those of you who aren't statisticians, dummy is not a pejorative term here. Dummy is just a constant that we take out. I just want to make that clear. So if we look at this far right column, number 5 on the far right, that 0.191 that has the 3 stars by it suggests that the illiquidity of the bonds held by closed-end funds is higher than it is for open-end funds by that constant amount. Okay, and again, we're talking about a bid-ask spread that has an average of you know, something on the order of 1%. Now, if we interact that closed-end fund dummy with leverage, we see that it goes down. So if we're talking about a closed-end fund that has leverage, they're going to hold less liquid bonds. So it does look like kind of we're seeing what we expect to see, which is that if you have leverage, you have another reason why you might have to sell your bonds when you don't want to. And so we're finding that. Now, the third question that I asked was, do closed-end funds earn a liquidity premium? And our answer is we're not sure. Okay, we need to do some other things to make sure, but certainly the simple statistics looked like they did. And what we're trying to do here is we do find some evidence here that, again, circled in the green box at the top, that closed-end funds do have higher returns. We do find that the markup, at least in the 12-month markup calculation, is statistically related to higher returns. So if they hold less liquid bonds, they do seem to have higher returns. And then we do find a leverage interaction, which is that the closed-end funds with higher leverage do also earn substantially higher returns, which is not all that surprising. Obviously, they're taking more risk because they're borrowing short, investing long on the term structure, and that's an old strategy. And then finally, my last bit of evidence that I wanted to talk about is what we do here is we say, let's take all the closed-end funds, and let's take all the open-end funds, and let's take a weighted average of their monthly returns. And we're going to subtract the open-end fund return from the closed-end fund return and see what that difference is and what it's related to. And so we're going to break that up into all of our funds, and then we break it up into a few subsets. But the basic idea here is, what is explaining the difference between closed-end fund returns and open-end fund returns? And if you look at our variables that we're going to use, think of this as the CAPM, where we have risk factors that we're estimating their influence on the returns. We have muni excess returns, so that is, we also have stock market excess returns, which don't seem to matter in any of these regressions. But the muni excess returns do, and very strongly across the board. We see the credit spread, which is a difference between the AAA and the BBB returns. And then we see the term spread mattering quite a bit. So if we're going to go out and explain closed-end fund returns relative to open-end fund returns, it looks like those three factors matter regardless of this comparison that we use, which is what we would expect. And what it tells us is that probably what's going on with the muni excess return is that's a leverage impact, right? So I'm taking more muni risk on the term structure. So that's what we're picking up in terms of this distinction. The credit spread, these closed-end funds are taking on average higher credit risk. That's what is implied, at least on average, across these different cases. And then the term spread, they're also taking more term structure. They're buying out longer, and we're seeing that manifest itself in these term spread returns. The important, actually, takeaway from this table is actually the top row, though. I mean, those are important because that helps us understand what kind of risks are being taken. The constant term up here tells us the alpha, okay? And so a couple of our subsamples, national muni long and single state funds, that's a statistically significantly negative alpha. The other ones, it's not statistically significant. However, it is negative, except for the muni national. So it suggests that the fees are quite a bit higher, and if we do this with gross returns rather than net returns, so we add back the fees, none of these are significant. So it seems like the fees are what's driving that negative alpha in a large part. Okay, I have 21 seconds left. So I'm going to call these preliminary findings. We find convincing evidence that closed-end funds are holding less liquid securities. We find that closed-end funds that employ leverage are also going to hold more liquid, or going to hold more liquid securities. And at this point, we're still working on kind of whether investors are benefiting from a liquidity premium or whether they're just receiving higher returns for risks that they're taking. And so that's work in progress. So very much look forward to comments and questions, and thank you very much.
Actually, had a great time working with John on this paper, and we actually got to know each other over the last month or so, and we had a lot of fun going back and forth, and we had more discussion than I thought we would have. But John, the paper, I thought how I would describe it, I think John has potentially a piece of heavy artillery. Very potent heavy artillery. My problem is I think it's pointed at the wrong target. Let me say at the outset, the studies that and by the way, there are no punches being pulled here. John and I, we've hashed this out over multiple conversations, and it's a good friendly exchange. I think the more relevant conversation, rather than closed-end fund versus open-end fund, is the new 22E4 role on liquidity for mutual funds. And what I'd love to see this study focus on is how you ascribe liquidity to, because as I'm sure most of you know, the SEC, starting in December, is going to require funds to categorize their securities in terms of buckets of liquidity. And this seems like it could be a really piece, a seminal piece of academic work on that very topic. And so I would encourage them to at least think about reworking or starting a different topic on 22E4. So John touched on their measures of liquidity, and I think this is probably where he and I differ on opinion. And you know, I argued with John at first. I said, no, you're using price. Price isn't the right thing. You should be using yield, because the market looks at yield, not prices, because the dollar value of an 01 basis point out in the 30-year part of the curve is different than the dollar value of an 01 in a 30-day piece of commercial paper, for example. So I began my argument saying yield, and then I got to thinking about it, and I thought, no. Actually, yield and price are exactly the same thing. And I think John was in part responsible for making me say that out loud when we were, and they are. They're describing, well, a little lecture. We're describing the same thing in different terms. Yield is price and price is yield. And in my judgment, when you're looking for liquidity, either one of those is wholly insufficient in describing liquidity. Why? Well, first thing that I think that John controls for is maturity, and we've seen that in the paper, and we've had this conversation. Maturity in the municipal market means very, very little, because it's a no-call 10 market. In other words, every new deal that comes to market, practically every new deal that comes to market, has a 10-year call. And actually, they're coming out with 6- and 7-year calls now, and those call structures are shortening because of the removal of advance refundings. But the point is, optionality matters. Optionality matters a lot in a market, and so maturity or prices or yields are insufficient in order to capture that optionality that we see in the market. So what I'm recommending to the authors is that they reconstruct what they're solving for, what they're defining liquidity is. And they have four inputs. As John mentioned, they have four inputs. Another one, which is suspect to me, is what they call zero-day trades. In other words, the frequency with which a bond trades. And we know experientially that when a new deal comes to market, it trades very actively for the first 2-3 months, and then it goes away. That's our terminology. It goes away, meaning it finds its way into investors' hands, and then it trades by appointment only. And so looking at the frequency with which a bond turns over is probably not a great measure of liquidity. You know, the analogy that I would use is the last time Starry Night, Van Gogh's Starry Night, changed hands was in 1941 when MoMA acquired it from an estate. I would not describe that as an illiquid painting. It's very liquid. If it were up for sale, estimates say it would probably transact at around $100 million, and you would have a huge number of bids. So looking at the time something transacts doesn't necessarily measure its liquidity. But back to price. So how do I think the right way to structure a measure of liquidity? And again, we've had this conversation. What I would recommend is using an OA model, option adjusted spread. So I would look at, and I know that there are those out there, and I'm not going to shout out at vendors, but there are those out there that do an excellent job at an iterative process in determining volatilities, and we can come up with an optionless and an option curve, and then we can calculate the OAS and the OAD, the effective, the option adjusted spread, and the option adjusted duration of a bond. And that really captures its interest rate sensitivity, and that accounts for optionality across the curve regardless of the structure. So here's how I would calculate that spread, if you will. I would take the OAS per unit of OAD. In other words, you're looking at a unit of spread per unit of interest rate risk. OAS per unit of OAD. A simple way to do that would take the bid offer OAS minus the offered side OAS and divide it by the bid side price. Duration isn't going to change that much with a couple of basis points of spread. And so then you can come up with, and I'm not a statistician, and Dr. Calate is sitting in the audience, and Chalmers is up here going to ridicule me, I'm sure. But it's a way to standardize or normalize that spread across the entire term structure. You're coming up with a number that, irrespective of whether it's a 10-year bond with a 3-year call or a 15-year bond with a 2-year call or whatever you're looking at, you have an OA, you have a measurement of liquidity there. You have spread per unit of risk. That of interest rate risk that you're taking, and I think that's an important difference, and I think that's fundamental to the entire study. I don't think maturity, I don't think yield cuts it. I think you need in a market that's rife with optionality, you need something to account for that optionality. The only other things that I would say are that. Two more things. I think that they need to control for. State and sector. We had this conversation. There are 22 sectors in the municipal market. We have 50 states, 5 territories in the District of Columbia. We need to control for these things because they trade in different stratospheres. Cal trades different than Oregon, for example. Cal trades different than New York. New York trades different than Georgia. Different tax structures and so forth. And we have a multiplicity of sectors, and they need to be accounted for. The last thing that I would say is what we're describing is liquid or not liquid. If we're asking the question why, then you can start to do performance attribution, a factor-based performance attribution where you're loading on these factors of sector, ratings categories, coupon, which I know you control for, and you can take the full term structure, you can use key rates then, or use D1, D2, D3, a parallel shift, a steepening, flattening, or twisting of the yield curve, convexity, yield, and then look at all these other factors. You can load on them, you create a model, and you get your residual, and then you can actually look at why. You can tease out the sources of returns and say why certain funds are performing better than other funds. I think to look at price and to ascribe liquidity as a reason, I think it probably falls short of the mark. So with that, I have a minute 33. I will cede my time.
Are you sure?
We'll start our civil question, answer, and perhaps ridiculing this portion. So, let's get George. You have a question?
Yes, thanks.
Could you wait for the mic? Affiliation.
Yeah.
State it as a question.
Sure.
Please.
There's something that really confuses me. I guess that's a question about the liquidity component.
That was a statement,
that's a statement.
George. Just to be clear.
I took it as a stab. Thank you. The liquidity question, which is two parts. One, the open-end funds did use leverage. They did it through TOBS. And I see Steve nodding. And I wonder how different the two were in the real world. There were open end funds using 99-to-1 leveraged TOBS that vanished in sometime around the end of 07. The second part is the crisis that the closed end funds went through in terms of their leverage, namely the preferred stock, which ended up creating massive lawsuits. And I don't know how that affected performance, and I'm wondering if you looked at any of that.
So first of all, the TOBS I'm aware of, but I wasn't as aware that they were primarily in these open end funds, and so we need to look at that more carefully.
But I think more in the open end funds because they didn't.
Because they couldn't do the other way. Yeah. But the data we have is from Mergent again, and so we're reporting what they're reporting. But the TOBS weren't counted as leverage in the way they counted it. So we need to fix that, and that's very helpful. I think with respect to the second question was
the crisis.
So our closed end fund performance, and I focused on the pre-crisis performance, is as you would expect. The closed end funds do very poorly during the crisis period as they have to unwind these illiquid positions as they're forced to, they have no funding anymore with the adjustable rate preferred drying up. So so I in the presentation, I kind of focused on the pre-crisis period, but during the crisis, you see the types of things you would expect to see. You would see underperformance of assets that are going to get killed in a crisis. So,
Dan, did you have a question here? Can you wait for the microphone?
Two questions. One is that
could you state your affiliation, please?
Oh, Dan Lee from Federal Reserve. One question is that you said that the closed-end fund hold the type of securities that are more illiquid, like, you know, they have longer durations, they have a higher markup. Have you looked at their credit quality distribution and also issuance size? Because those are highly correlated with round-trip transactions, right?
Try to control.
You
got to
hit that button.
Did it go off?
It goes off after 20 seconds.
Oh, okay.
trying to save money here on electricity.
We tried to control for a number of those things. I also kind of skipped. We did, and Steve mentioned it. We have four measures of liquidity, which we used as variables to identify whether or not the funds hold less liquid assets. And so we have that on the left hand side, and then we kind of have the factor analysis, which I showed at the very end of my presentation, which tried to control for performance attribution, really. And so the short answer to your question is we need to do a better job on duration. But we did control for things like maturity. So
it would be just interesting to know that what are the dimensions they add to the illiquidity. Are they primarily loading on, you know, high yield bond, or are they going to the really, really tiny municipalities? You know, what are the dimensions they play with? And the other question is that you use the return on closed-end fund, right? Instead of, unlike mutual fund, it's actually NAV, it's the prices of the underlyings, whereas with the closed-end fund, it's the prices that's traded. So there's a component of this premium versus discount, and that's typically in the academic literature, people use that as a sentiment measure, right? And it would be interesting to know, like, if you tease out that sentiment piece and just look at underlying prices, what do you get in terms of return?
We did do an analysis where we took the holdings themselves and we looked at their actual returns. The problem with that, or the reason that I worry about that a little bit, is that we actually don't have every holding. We only do it if we have 90% of the holdings of the individual funds. And then the other problem is then we have to figure out what each of those is worth. And we're using EMMA data, so we're going to see, you know, we're going to see a bond trade once a month, and we're going to have to come up with a price. So we do try that with holdings-based returns, and we do actually find, you know, arguably stronger evidence that there is a return premium in those holdings, in the illiquid.
John, can I get the gentleman behind you, John? We'll get to you next. Thanks.
Bob Chirinka, University of Illinois, Chicago. The thesis of this paper is that there's a liquidity problem with open-end mutual funds, right, that basically the closed-end mutual fund is solving. The question I have is, why don't big mutual fund companies like Fidelity and Vanguard solve this problem by collecting, you know, having a pool of resources that would have solved these liquidity problems for any one of their funds? Law of large numbers would suggest that a lot of that liquidity problems could be smoothed out over a number of large funds.
Great point. We do see, and this is actually in Jing Yun's PhD thesis, that actually, and it's in some of the results here, that large families hold more illiquid bonds, and we do see them able to move the bonds across the different funds on their platform. And so to some extent they do, but you know, I think it's about 30% of closed-end funds are muni funds, which also tells you something about organizational form and what may work.
John?
Thanks. I was just thinking about the results where you do the sort of difference decomposition right near the end, where it looks like you have very high R-squares, and I think you could, you know, use that in a different way by you know, in some ways taking the, that difference or the return attribution and taking it seriously as like a style decomposition and running that regression with, instead of focusing on the alphas, take run it without a constant and force all the coefficients to sum to one. And that would give you sort of what the percentage of the return is attributed to the various factors. And that would allow you to put in something like VIX or something that might be correlated with the optionality underlying the portfolio. And you could sort of do things like that, even with the ITRAX or ITRAX kind of squared, maybe not in the 2001 to 2007 period, but you could put a lot more stuff on the right-hand side in terms of performance attribution.
Okay, good idea. Thanks.
Dan, you got a question here?
I want to push back as civilly as I can. I think if we define liquidity as the ability to convert a bond into cash, you know, at minimal discount very quickly, I think that the liquidity of any instrument is not necessarily just a standalone characteristic of that instrument. It's a characteristic of whose portfolio it lands in, right? So if you want to predict whether a bond will be a bond that you can sell with minimal discount, if it lands in a portfolio that is sort of an active trader, it's going to tend to be more liquid. It will have a higher level of latent liquidity, even if you don't see it trade, because it's held by somebody who's deeply engaged with traders. And so it's not, you could take the same bond, precisely the same characteristics, but if you put it into sort of a very active portfolio, it will tend to be a more liquid bond. So I just want to push back on it seems in the background as an assumption that liquidity is a characteristic of the bond, the instrument itself, rather than a characteristic of the bond investor match.
Excellent point. So, I mean, the bonds that these, another way to say what I think you're saying is the bonds that are purchased by these funds are inherently going to be more liquid than bonds that are not purchased by these funds.
So actually, this may be a silly thought, but I was wondering if you could look at funds that own Puerto Rico bonds and assuming that they are illiquid or at least distressed, see if they were owned disproportionately by open-end or close-end funds, kind of to Dan's point that somebody that could bear the illiquidity of a Puerto Rico bond would have a higher propensity to own it.
That's a great point, Rich. And you know, it depends how we define liquidity. You know, one of the most actively traded bonds when they came out were Puerto Rico 8s of 38. They were and they were junk, and they were the most actively traded, you know, piece of junk that you could find. In fact, they were more often traded. They had more volume than any other. CUSIP on the street for a long time, and yet none of us would describe that bond as a liquid bond. At least not today, we wouldn't.
Any other questions? George, one last quick question. We got a couple minutes. And we want to get to the real exciting panel that I know you'll have a question on.
One of the tricky things for me in terms of open versus closed end is that the closed end don't have to sell because there are no inflows and outflows, and I'm wondering how that affected your comparison between the closed-end funds and the open-end funds.
Well, that's kind of our expectation. That's really where our hypothesis comes from, is that these closed-end funds are created in maybe one of the reasons they're created is to exploit the fact that they can hold less liquid assets and earn higher returns for a liquidity premium that they earn there. So I think again, given that so many closed end funds are muni funds, tells you that may be an area where that can be done. You can earn a liquidity premium there, and that's what we're looking for. Are there no new ones since 08? I'd have to check, but I mean, we have a bunch of them. Yeah, I'd have to, you I'm sure know the data better than I do, but we will have all the data, so I'm not gonna give up any organs though.
All right, I'm gonna call it there. We'll move to our third panel. Thank you, gentlemen. Okay, so next up is Dr. Andy Kalate presenting for his seventh of seven times at the conference. And I know we talk about passion. Andy is passionate. He's going to probably get into OAS and all of that sort of stuff and liquidity and whatnot. So, Andy, be mindful of our time. And then Adam Looney from Brookings will come up and discuss, and then we'll move into our final Q&A.
Okay. Thanks, Rich. And thanks, Steve Winterstein, because he already summarized my primary finding. In case you missed that, he said, due to the elimination of advance refunding, bonds are being issued with 6 and 7 year calls. Am I quoting you correctly?
And I'm sorry.
It's all right. It helps. So this is about life without advance refunding. And just to make sure all of you know what advance refunding is, I'm going to use a couple of my valuable minutes to explain it. It's a very simple transaction, yet some people find it very confusing. So what happens, the municipality would sell a new issue and then buy treasury bonds that defease the outstanding issue to the call date. And then it's called legally defease the issue. And then on the call date, the old bond would be called and the new bond would stay out. Now, the basic problem, if you like, with advance refunding is that now you have two issues outstanding. At one point, you could have as many as three issues outstanding supporting the same project. So that's why it was eliminated. Why should you have $300 million worth of bonds supporting a $100 million project? Just to give you an example, suppose the outstanding bond has a 5% coupon, 25 years to go and 5 years to call. So the current rate, 25-year rate, is 4%, and you could earn on the escrow 3%. The value of the, or the price of the outstanding bond would be, if you leave it outstanding, is 115 and change, but the escrow would be only 109 and change. So you could save about 6.5 points. Savings by advance refunding. That's how the transaction worked. And if the old bond happened to have a 6% coupon, then you would save even more. Now, one small point, this case where the refunding rate is 4% and the escrow yield is 3%, people refer to it as negative arbitrage, which, by the way, happens to be a misnomer, but I will not get into it. So that's how it worked, and this was very critical to the current practice of issuing 5% bonds callable after 10 years. You heard Steve say that is the predominant institutional structure. 5% bonds callable after 10 years at par. And you say, well, what's such a good deal? Why have these bonds, 5% bonds, when rates are roughly 3%? You're issuing bonds 200 basis points above current interest rates at a high premium. Well, from the investors, institutional investors' perspective, it turns out that when rates increase, bonds which trade around par or below par perform much worse than bonds that trade above par. So if you're marked to market, you don't want to see your portfolio suffer, and you buy premium bonds. And most institutions simply will not hold bonds below 102 or 103, because they don't want them to fall below par. So that explains the 5% part. But what about this non-call 10? And that's the really interesting part. That has to do with the advance refunding. So they are literally tailor-made for advance refunding. First of all, the issuers refund a 5% bond where it's at 3% or 4%. And they show enormous savings, so everybody's very happy. They go to their constituents, and they keep saying, look how much we saved by refunding. Of course, the old bonds were never meant to stay outstanding for 30 years anyway, because everybody knew that they would be called after 10 years, but they are refunded even earlier. The investors like the advance refundings. First of all, one reason is because typically the issuers call too early. That's kind of a waste of option. But also, the bonds become AAA once they are advance refunded. So there's a are two ways to gain from it. And then finally, very importantly, this whole infrastructure supporting issuance of new bonds. So you have the underwriters, you have the lawyers, you have the financial advisors, the people who compute the yields, the printers, the rating agencies, and so on and so forth. And there's an enormous amount of churning, costing enormous amounts of money to the municipalities, but nobody talks about it. And that has been a major issue with this advance refunding, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, so one more point. Oops, I'm sorry. Hang on. I have to go back. As a result of this 5% non-call 10 bond structure, the yield curves today are all in terms of, are for 5% non-call 10. They are not par curves like you have it in treasuries. It assumes the first 10 years are optionless bonds, and then beyond that, we show the yield to calls of bonds callable after 10 years at par. So here it would be at 3% would be the 30-year. The yield of a 5% 30-year bond callable in year 10 at par. So that's the standard yield curve. All right. So, I'm sorry. So one very important point about advance refunding, probably the most important point I'm going to make and least controversial, advance refunding was an option and it had value. Many academics argued that it had no value, which is interesting enough. They couldn't understand that. Even though a moment of reflection, they're convinced that it has value. And how much it is, how much that value was, that's kind of questionable. It depends on assumptions about volatility and the correlation of treasuries with muni rates and so on and so forth, but it had value. And I estimate, I published a paper with Lori Ranieri, we gave a paper here last year or 2 years ago, where we said it's worth at least 1 point. It was worth at least 1 point. That value is gone now. There's nothing that can be done to create that value. And people are trying to do alternatives such as forward swaps, forward the Cinderella bus, all kinds of gimmicky things. But its value cannot be recreated. It's like Humpty Dumpty. It's gone. And that translates into increased cost to the municipal issuer, everything else being the same. So the cost of municipal bonds, everything else being the same, will be somewhat higher. Now, what else is going to happen in the capital markets? Well, the first prediction I'm making is that because the infrastructure wants to see some action, they will say, let's have bonds with shorter call. 4 year, 5 year, 6 year. We have seen some bonds, 5% bonds with callable after 3 years, believe it or not. So that's one important point. But then the second question comes up. Could you issue, what's the point of issuing a 5% bond callable after 5 years or 3 years or 4 years? Do you know that bond is going to be called? So why bother having such a bond? Why not just issue straight optionless bonds? So the answer to that would be, in my opinion, is to have coupons below 5%, or there's an alternative that I don't discuss, but it's another possibility, is to have call prices much higher than 100. You could make these bonds callable at 110 or 115, if you like. And that was actually suggested at one point. Vin Smith, as you may recall, he wrote a paper in The Bond Buyer suggesting to have issues with higher call prices, but not, you cannot have 5% bonds callable at par, because those are just certain to be called. So, I'm sorry, I keep on. Why do I have so much trouble? Hang on. Okay, here we go. So the third point I would like to make is that if you start issuing bonds with coupon lower than 5% and call protection less than 10 years, you cannot have this old, the traditional yield curve of 5% bonds callable after 10 years at par. You need different types of yield curves. I'm not sure what will be. It's kind of speculative to say that we'll have 4% bond callable after 6 years, but it's interesting to kind of wonder what they would look like. And here's an example, just I'm going to do this very quickly. So if you look at the blue line, that's the 5% non-call 10, which I showed you before. And the green line is the 4% non-call 6 bond, which would be equivalent to the blue line. But it has a very funny shape. And you see a 4% non-call 6 bond would yield in 30 years 3.4%. So you can, if you, with the right analytics, and Steve already referred to this OES-based technology, you can go back and forth. And actually what's needed is ultimately is a single yield curve, and in my favorite would be a just a par optionless curve, which is the red line shown here. So we could have all kinds of yield curves, but ultimately I don't think the 5% non-call 10 curve is going to survive forever. There will be a need for alternative yield curves. Okay. So I already mentioned a number of times that we are going to need option-based analytics. And in particular, Steve mentioned this acronym, the OES, which has been used in every other part of the fixed income markets for many, many years, whether you talk about structure, mortgage-backed securities or corporate bonds or agency bonds. And the question is, why is it not being used in munis? And I think we'll be forced to start using that technology. And this excuse that munis are different, it never made any sense to me, and it still doesn't. And munis are not different. It's just the muni analysts are different, I think. I mean it, sincerely. There's just no excuse for not using the right technology. And we are going to be forced, because there will be such a variety of different structures, we'll be forced to make to use technology which is appropriate for these options, these bonds with options. Just to give you one example, here is something. How do you define when to call? Because going forward, we are calling bonds. We are not going to be doing advanced refundings. And, of course, bonds have been called forever. And what's the right way to decide when to call? And I want to show you something which has been used since 1976 in the corporate market. How do you define when to call? There's this notion called refunding efficiency. You look at how much you save, which, of course, the people love to show, but they never show the option value, which is you see how much optionality do I give up on the old bond and how much optionality do I get in the new bond, because most of the time the refunding bonds themselves are also callable. So you have to use both optionality and cash flow savings to determine when to call. And again, I want to emphasize this has been used since 1976, which is how many years? 42 years. Now, to finish it up, looking at muni advisors, I think they're going to be under some pressure to use the right technology. Currently, they are not using analytics. Very few of them use state-of-the-art analytics, to the best of my knowledge. Most of them go by these rules of thumb that I looked at the GFOA document, which describes how to when to do refundings in general. And it says, well, you do it when you have MPV savings of 3% or 5% or some number like that. You say, where did it come from? And people say, well, that's what we always used. And you say, well, why? And there's no explanation for that. So I think we're going to have to start using this option-based refunding rules. The other thing, another topic which is kind of relevant, the TIC, which is the standard for determining which bond to choose in a competitive deal. And TIC, true interest cost, for those of you who are not familiar with that, doesn't look at optionality. And so how do you compare a 4% bond callable in 6 years to a 5% bond callable in 10 years? Somehow you have to recognize that they have different optionality, and there is something called TIC Plus, which is actually available in iPrio, but people have not been using it. It's time to start thinking about it. And finally, I think it's up to the MSRB to include these option-based analytical tools in the requirements. They should have been included ages ago, and it is really a good time to take this seriously and test whoever wants to qualify as a municipal advisor should have familiarity with these tools. And I'll stop right here.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss this interesting paper. I wanted to step back for a second before discussing the topic of life after advanced refunding and to talk about why we're talking about life after advanced refunding. And obviously that's because we just had a tax reform that ended the practice. And so before getting to the main questions of the paper, I wanted to talk about the goals of that tax reform, the reasons why advanced refunding was deemed an acceptable provision to eliminate, and whether we should anticipate that this change is permanent or something that might come back. So among the many objectives of the recent tax bill, there were clearly efforts to raise revenue by closing tax expenditures, to simplify complicated areas of the tax code, to target provisions that were deemed to be inefficient or unproductive, and to reduce federal subsidies flowing to state and local governments more generally. Hence, I think it was natural to look at the municipal bond market in general and at advanced refunding in particular. So with this in mind, my first observation is that I think the municipal bond market survived the tax cut surprisingly well, at least in terms of how much the reform targeted revenues from the municipal bond market. So prior to this reform, the Joint Committee on Taxation had estimated that the tax expenditure, the subsidy for the exclusion of interest on public purpose state and local government bonds was about $41 billion a year over the next couple of years. In early drafts of the tax reform plan, the Republicans had clearly proposed much larger reductions in the subsidy, including the total repeal of private activity bonds. In the end, the revenue effects of the bond provisions in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act were relatively modest. It ended advanced refunding and eliminated the relatively small portion of the market that was used in tax credit bonds. And the Joint Committee estimated that the repeal of advanced refunding would raise about $2 billion a year over the next few years, which is relatively small in comparison to the $41 billion subsidy that they had estimated. And indeed, that estimate probably far overstates the true impairment to issuers of municipal bonds because of how the JCT scores those provisions. In particular, the JCT only scores the revenue provisions of this change and not the changes in spending. So it excludes the fact that the Treasury had saved money by paying lower interest rates on slugs, on state and local government securities. So in short, the scoring conventions mean that they only counted the fact that there are fewer tax-exempt securities in the market, but not any net savings to the Treasury that had arisen earlier from the fact that they got to issue lower-yielding state and local government securities rather than taxable treasuries. And so as a result, the budgetary consequences of the bill were probably much smaller, and the amount of federal subsidy that was lost that had accrued to state and local governments were probably correspondingly lower. And so there's no doubt that the reform reduced the total of tax expenditure for municipal bonds. In the JCT's estimation, it was a cut of about 25% of the total subsidy, but that was almost entirely because tax rates are lower, not because of the elimination of advanced refunding or any of the other changes that they had made. So in that regard, I think the muni market escaped worse fates in this reform. Moreover, I think that there were good policy reasons to eliminate advanced refunding, which will be hard to overcome in the future. So, one goal of tax reform was simplification, And clearly the repeal of advance refunding advanced that goal. If nothing else, advance refunding was complicated. It required a lot of expertise from people like you. It required a dedicated team at the IRS, a team armed with, a three-volume operations manual and training manual to monitor compliance. And it required a separate Treasury office in, I think, Parkersburg, West Virginia, to issue the state and local government securities. And so while some of that apparatus is still going to be needed to deal with bonds that had been grandfathered, clearly there was a lot of administrative capacity and cost that was eliminated from the system by eliminating this practice. In addition, and I think more controversially, advance refunding was viewed by policy researchers and the academic community as an inefficient way of subsidizing state and local governments, and even one that could be disadvantageous to the issuers, and thus one that they had targeted for elimination just on that basis. So clearly there are widely divergent opinions about how valuable advance refunding is to municipal issuers. And I'm not here to assert that advance refunding was bad for issuers. But I wanted to describe that view because I think it was one that was relevant to this tax reform and that will continue to be relevant to people who had participated in that practice. And so I think that that negative view of advance refunding was informed by the idea that defeasance in general is a transaction that was at best zero sum and at worst was one that destroyed value for an issuer, at least financial value. So in the textbook case of defeasance, an issuer issues a new bond to purchase escrow that finances payments on the pre-existing issue. In that textbook example, a transaction like that cannot create financial value. That's because the price of the escrow needed to finance the existing bond payments must equal, in present value, the price of the existing bond. So with a callable bond, in contrast, the option to call has clear value. Instead of paying a coupon of, say, 10%, if the interest rate is 5%, I can call the bond, I can issue a new one at 5%, I can pay 5% instead of 10%, and I can keep the difference. But with a bond that's not callable, the issuer always has to pay the 10% coupon. So the cost kind of doesn't go away in a early call or an advance refunding. And so that basic arithmetic had led some observers to conclude that advance refunding provides no upside to the issuers. Indeed, some suggest that there was only downside when you factor in the fees, the credit enhancement that advance refunding provides to bondholders, and the foregone value of the option not to call should rates rise or to call at a lower rate should rates decline. Now, I think that conclusion is overstated for some reasons. First, the costs associated with advance refunding are probably not that large. Some fees would have been inevitable when the bonds were eventually called. The credit enhancement for bondholders was probably partially priced into the original issue. And the early exercise of the option, while maybe not optimal, was probably not that costly. Second, and I think more importantly, it was that Treasury mispriced slugs, and they offered them to issuers at kind of too high a yield. In that, as a result, the municipality often got to purchase escrow at a discount to the price of their existing bonds. Again, that's because the formula for the rate Treasury provided to municipal borrowers resulted in a subsidy that could increase the value of the refunding. And I think that was basically a free lunch to issuers, but one that was ultimately paid for by the Treasury through higher interest rates. And then I also should say that I think advance refunding could provide value to the issuer simply by changing the timing of payments and extending the duration of the bond. To a credit-constrained government, this could free up cash today and return for higher payments in the future. To some observers, I think this was viewed as an illicit form of regulatory arbitrage, states and localities breaking their own rules to free up cash when they were otherwise prohibited from borrowing directly. And so, that's one view. I think another view is that state and local governments were facing, when they faced temporary fiscal stress, like they did during a last recession and other times, they might be perfectly justified from borrowing, and it might be better for their constituents to do so. And so that kind of restructuring of their debt provided real value. But even if it wasn't necessarily bad for the issuer, it was also, I think, hard to argue that it was a particularly cost-effective or an efficient way to subsidize, for the federal government to subsidize state and local activity. And so I think that those were some of the reasons why it was targeted and why I think it'll be hard to argue to bring it back. So now that we're back to life after advance refunding, the question of what it will look like. And so in some regards, I do agree with Andy that borrowing costs will increase, but by a relatively modest amount. On the structure of the bonds and what they will look like in the future, I think I have relatively few predictions. So one question I have is what led to the 5% NC10 in the first place? In my mind, it's kind of like the decision to drive on the right-hand side of the road or to stop on red and go on green. It's an arbitrary choice in some ways, but it's important for efficiency that everybody agree on the same thing. And so from that perspective, I could imagine the 5% bond persisting for some time just out of inertia or common agreement, or I could imagine a new norm becoming established. My other suggestion or question was to look at the market for private activity bonds. Those bonds have not been eligible for advance refunding, I think ever, or at least for quite some time. And so my question is basically, are those issued at 5% coupons? And if not, do they provide some indication of what government bonds will look like in the future? Again, so I appreciate the opportunity to comment, and it's an issue I imagine we'll be dealing with for some time, and so I look forward to our discussion. Thank you.
A little something there for everybody. So we heard about the way we were from Andy and why we were the way we were, and then Adam pretty much made us realize we'll never be that way again. And then Andy suggested that'll be a more expensive world that we'll be living in as municipal issuers, that there may be some new structures to allow us to try to recapture some of the way we were, and that those new structures will require new tools, new expertise, et cetera. So a lot there. I'm looking forward to the audience questions. So one to a customer. So, George, you want to spend your question now?
Yes.
All right.
My question has to do with what data there is that shows more lower coupon paper. And I asked Steve about this too. And we're both dealing with anecdotal issues. And I don't know the answer. I know that there were short call paper early in 18. When there just wasn't a lot of paper around. And Dr. Calate, are you aware of what the pattern has been of late? Is there short call paper around? Because I don't think there is.
I really haven't been following it, George, but I knew that there was a 5% bond callable in 3 years.
Wisconsin did some, California did some.
Yeah, there were a few of those. And I know that there have been some 7-year and 8-year, but I really don't follow it. But the question is not what's going to happen in the next 2 months. The question is, where are we going to be a year from now, or 2 years from now, or 3 years from now? Are we still going to have the exclusively 5% non-call 10s? And the answer is, I guarantee, no, there will be. In particular, there's another structure that I don't even mention. We need long optionless paper. We don't have any of that either. I mean, the 5% non-call 10s completely dominate the institutional market.
I mean, I see an issuer, prolific issuer, raising his hand. Ben, could you say your affiliation for the benefit of the group?
So I'm Ben Watkins with the state of Florida, doing my part to keep the state in debt. And so a couple of things, a couple of observations. One is, Adam, I appreciate your perspective on what went down in D.C. I respectfully disagree. I think zero thought went into this. It was a pay-for, and that was completely it. It disrespects a federal-state relationship. It's un-American to allow us not to refinance our debt at lower interest rates. So
be civil, Ben.
I am. Just a different point of view, that's all. And so, and we're, Dr. Kolodnik, so we've looked at various call structures and trying to evaluate something different than a 10-year no-call structure. And it's the point that we always come to is you have to pay up for a shorter call. And then the question is, with regarding the price of the option, you have to rely on an assumption about where rates are going to be in the future in order to properly value. And that's the impediment that we have never gotten to. Why should I pay today more than I have to in order to have a shorter call? And so we passed. I agree completely that there is there's a lot to be done around that in terms of trying to inform decision making, but it's not quite as proscriptive maybe as it's not as quite an easy an answer, even though we have better information.
Okay. Great question, and I'd like to become one thing that you said, we have to rely on assumptions. And the answer is no, you don't. There are standard, well-understood techniques, and that's what I'm referring to, that have been used for 40 years, and about how interest rates move. And it's not guessing where rates move. There are well-accepted standard interest rate processes. And this is exactly what people have to, in a municipal market, have to recognize. It's not a guessing game. It's playing with the professionals and playing like a professional.
Can Peter Rohr? Sorry.
Okay.
I'll get you next, Alan, after Peter. Thanks.
It's a quick handoff.
Who are you with?
I'm with Public Alternative Municipal Advisor. I think this is civil, but I'm wondering if we're not getting high on our own.
If you have to say that,
supply.
It probably
yeah,
isn't.
Exactly. No, but I wonder if we're not getting high on our own quantitative supply. And I got an advanced degree in math at the University of Chicago, so I love models probably more than most. But dovetailing on what you said, Andy, a few minutes ago, you talked about how there was a lack of optionless bonds in the market, correct? And when you talked earlier during your discussion about the lack and the sort of stubborn resistance to the muni market of using the right technology, part of the reason why other markets have used OAS technology for decades successfully is because there is a reliable non-call benchmark out there that you can do OAS against. The muni market doesn't have a riskless non-call benchmark because of the lack of those types of bonds. It just doesn't exist. So when you talk about how you don't need to predict interest rates from an issuer's perspective, you're assuming that there's sort of a hedgeable market. There are assumptions underneath that which don't exist for municipal issuers. And I'm wondering if that's why there seems to be this stubborn resistance for all these dumb muni people to not use the right models that have been out there for decades. So is that, you think there's a correlation to those things?
I disagree with you. First of all, you can estimate, and some of the professionals do estimate the optionless long-term rates, and we can talk about it. You can find them,
right?
And you can extract them using standard option-based analytics. I mean, I just don't see what the problem is. The problem is that most municipal people today don't know enough about the analytics, and they don't realize that these tools exist to make rational, well-accepted, using a well-accepted methodology to make rational decisions. And I talk to, I'm most concerned about the advisors who acknowledge that they don't know what's going on. And they rely on these voodoo finance assumptions on 3% MPV rule and 5% this and that. It's completely unwarranted, in my opinion.
Voodoo is a civil term of art. I'll remind everybody that at 5:30 there'll be a cocktail party where we'll be getting together to discuss this in a very low key fashion. Alan, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm Alan Garman with the Maryland Transportation Authority.
Yeah, I think my question relates to all of this, the concepts in the industry like option-adjusted tick and why there's such a reluctance to, you know, use a more technical approach and why heuristics are in use sort of prevalently by the municipal advisory industry. And so I'm getting to my question here, but, you know, the SEC after the financial crisis looked at the industry and they found that a lot of the advisors weren't competent to give the advice that they were giving. And, you know, the MSRB came out and said, okay, we're going to regulate the industry. We're going to give them a fiduciary duty. But what they didn't do was really test competence with the licensing requirement. And, you know, I know there was a group of us out there that were asking for tests of competence because we wanted to sort of push the industry forward. And that's not what the exam's about. And so I'm wondering, you know, why they didn't test competence with the registration requirement. And is there any sort of expectation that that will change?
Sorry, is that a rhetorical question, or do you want our various opinions on that?
I'm curious about, you know, why they didn't test competence. Was it because the 525 whatever registered advisors that are mostly two-person shops fought against it, or was it just too much too soon? And I'm wondering if you all have heard anything about sort of how the industry might change.
Yeah, I certainly have now.
But I heard from you, Alan, the story about when you were doing an issue and you suggested using Tick Plus. You suggested using Tick Plus, and your advisor said, "No, nobody's using it. Let's go with Tick." And you can relate to the group what happened, what you found out.
So I have a question there.
So I actually was going to respond to the idea of
Could you remind us?
Marianne Edmonds. Was going to respond to the idea of competency-based testing and the issue of maybe, I don't want to say too much too soon, but the MSRB was faced with developing the Series 50. And as Andy knows, because he and I spent a few meetings together on one of these qualification committees, I think we both left it before they got to the point where they released the Series 50. But you know, you're taking a totally unregulated industry, and you have to think about the steps that you have to take to get from that place to having sophisticated mathematical analysis on a test. And so I would expect over time that we may see more rigorous testing. In the same way we've seen that in other parts of the industry. I would also say that while I think at my shop we do a pretty decent job of doing analytics and trying to, we may not get it right every time. Don't anybody say I said that. But, you know, I think we do a pretty decent job of that. But let's remember that, and I'm going back to those people in Iowa, there aren't that many sophisticated financial advisor shops that practice truly nationally. You know, if you want to find somebody who's going to do financial advisory work for a small community in Utah, if you don't call Zions Bank, you don't call PFM, who are you going to call? So you know, let's remember that we don't want to take away the ability of some of these small issuers to have access to some advice, though it may not be the advice that meets the standards that some of us may want to see eventually.
So I think, David, you're going to get our last question. David Wessel.
Adam, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to Ben Watkins' assertion. I'm serious. So I think what's interesting about these pay-fors is that they develop over time. And we know there was academic attacks, which Andy referred to and you referred to. So just how does something like this find its way into a tax bill?
I mean, I do think it was thought about. I mean, so on the one hand, you said it was just to pay for. And so in some sense, yes, it was just to pay for. But, I mean, they had a big menu of items that they could have used as pay-fors. I think one of the buckets they selected was the municipal bond bucket, so to speak. And they scoured that list to think for things that they thought were that would least impair the special relationship between the federal government and the states. And the ones that were kind of least harmful. And so I think that there has been a long-term scrutiny of the different provisions that in the tax code that provide benefits to state and local governments. I think over time, advance refunding had migrated to the bottom of that list in terms of its impression of being something that provided a lot of value to the localities. That might be wrong on the merits, but I don't think that that was the impression that people in here in Washington had. I think that they viewed it as not something that was not super valuable to the constituents. I thought it was something that was very complicated, that it didn't deliver a lot of value per dollar of federal tax expenditure. And so I think that that's why it was the last thing that remained on the list, and the one thing that didn't get taken off in the last conference volume, so a conference agreement. So I think that, you know, you look at the longer time horizon. I do think that they had thought about it, and this element was the one that was kind of the one that just didn't make the cut in this reform when they were looking for the pay for.
Okay, I think we'll conclude on that note. Just a couple of quick housekeeping things. We reconvene tomorrow at 7:45 for breakfast. And, David, what, there is a bus out front taking folks to dinner that will be hosted by Brandeis, WashU, UChicago, and the Brookings. We look forward to seeing you there. And thanks, gentlemen, for your comments.